Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. I'm Stephen Lyons, guest host and a member of the National Book Critics Circle. Today we'll have what I hope is a lively conversation with Hannah Rosin, author of God's Harvard, a Christian college on a mission to save America. The book is just out from Harcourt Books and is what I would describe as a work of deep journalism. Our guest was embedded, if you will, for 18 months at Patrick Henry College, a small evangelical college in Virginia. This is a fascinating book that I think speaks to the heart of what many fear is a diminishing divide between state and religion. At the same time, these students and graduates of Patrick Henry have admirable values and they intend to be fully engaged in our political system. And who could argue with that? So we have lots to talk about thanks to the excellent reportage of our guest. Journalist Hannah Rosin has written for many publications, including The Washington Post, GQ, New Republic, New York Times, and The New Yorker, where a piece of this book first appeared in the June 27, 2005 issue under the title God and Country. As our listeners know, we welcome calls. In fact, we depend on them. Our local number is 333-9455 or long distance 1-800-222-9455. Again, that's 333-9455 or long distance 1-800-222-9455. Thanks for being with us today, and welcome to Focus 580, Hannah.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. It's a fascinating book, just fascinating. What was the genesis of God's Harvard?
I was covering religion and politics for the Washington Post in 2004 after Bush's reelection, and back then there was a lot of talk about the values vote and how the 4 million evangelicals who voted for Bush had made such a difference. That's what Karl Rove used to say. So I wanted to write about this notion of evangelicals suddenly having such a prominent and mainstream role in politics as opposed to what we're used to thinking of them as, which is a protest group, the Christian Coalition, the moral majority, kind of storming from the fringes. Here they were at the centers of power. And so I wanted to find the new generation and what this mainstreamization had done to their mentality about politics.
And, of course, in the book you devote a section to talking about the difference between this wave of evangelicals and what you could call the Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell evangelicals that came on maybe during the Reagan era.
Right. Michael Farris, who's the founder of the college, was one of the leaders in the homeschooling movement and also one of the first wave of politicians to really quote the Bible, I mean, to really be Bible quoting as opposed to just say I'm a Christian, and was very aggressive about his fundamentalism and his campaign for lieutenant governor of Virginia, which was in 1992. And he got a huge amount of attention for that race just for being a novelty, but he also lost the race. And I think what he realized and part of the mentality he transfers to the students is you can't do it that way. You can't be that forthright. You have to be a little more sophisticated in what you say and how you say it. And that's why this generation is different. They don't have the temperament of renegades the way that Michael Farris, Jerry Falwell, those guys did. The temperament they have is more of professionals. If you walk around campus, you'll see boys wearing suits to class and girls wearing outfits that look like young interns, and everybody's very polished, and they sound almost rehearsed when you interview them.
And perhaps they have a bended ear in the White House.
They definitely have a bended ear in this White House. I mean, it's something they really take for granted, like the way most college kids say, you know, I'll finish my final term paper, you know, I'll do this, I'll do that, and then I'll go work at the White House. That's partly because of the perfect harmony they've had with this White House. It hasn't been perfect, I should say, from the White House's point of view. There's sometimes an uneasy relationship between this White House and evangelicals, but they perceive it as harmony, and they perceive it as kind of an open door for them.
Let's get back to your reporting methods, because I do a lot of journalism. I'm just always fascinated to know how a journalist goes about a project like this. What were your reporting methods, and what was your biggest challenge?
My biggest challenge is that I am a secular Jewish woman who's a journalist and grew up in New York and Washington, so I've got all the elements in my biography which would make them suspicious of me, and I think evangelicals have been rightly suspicious of the mainstream media or the left media or the liberal media, as they always like to call it, and so I'm starting off kind of on the wrong foot. When I went in to write my New Yorker story, I had known Michael Farris, and I think they do want attention for their school. They do understand that they're doing something of historic significance, so it is kind of a double-edged sword. So part of it was getting over that suspicion and spending enough time at the school and enough time with the students that they could really open up and tell me something interesting about what this process was like for them to go from homeschooling to the mainstream.
From reading your book, it sounds like you had excellent access. You were able to wander around the campus, go into classrooms, interview students during their breaks, go home with the students, even to Idaho, which we can talk about in a little bit. Is that the case? Were you denied any access at all?
Not really. I mean, what worked in my favor is that the New Yorker piece ran before I started reporting this book. So I intended to just write a New Yorker piece, and they weren't unhappy with the piece. They felt that, relatively speaking, the piece treated them fairly, that it did a straightforward analysis of what the school's mission was. And in that story, I focused on two particular students, a boy and a girl. And it wasn't completely praising of the school, but they did feel that it was fair. And so I asked to come back to write a book because the piece generated a lot of interest, my New Yorker story, and I asked to come back. And I think they had a large debate about it at the school, and they ultimately decided to say yes. And I think partly it's not because they loved me and trusted me absolutely. I think it's partly because they do see themselves as playing a historic role in evangelical history and in American history, and I think they find it natural and important that that role be documented by, as they used to say, a Washington Post reporter is here watching me and, you know, documenting what we're doing.
Did Michael Ferris or any of the students try to convert you?
That would happen. That's something I write about in the introduction, that when I first started covering religion, the attempts at converting me, and that's because I'm Jewish and have an Israeli family, were extremely aggressive. And I would get them all the time when I went around the country. And I attribute that to a slightly less sophisticated mode of the Christian right. Whereas with the students, it was really much more subtle. You know, it was really much more by example, which is what they tell them. You know, when you go out to the White House or you have your job in Hollywood, you know, don't go out there and wave your Bible in everybody's face. That's not the way to do it. You should just evangelize by example. You know, show that you are a happy, productive, fulfilled person, and you want people to come up to you and say, why are you a happy, fulfilled person? Now, a couple of the freshmen would definitely say to me when we got into these late-night conversations on a debate trip or on a long road trip or something, they would, you know, press me on my faith and really kind of push me on a little bit more in a sympathetic tone, like I'd feel bad for you if you were to, you know, if something were to happen to you and you weren't right with Jesus. It was more just kind of, you know, I love you and I feel bad for you, more than any kind of banging the Bible on my head.
Did it make you confront your own Judaism?
It did not, I'm afraid to say. I definitely have had friends who spent a lot of time among evangelicals. I mean, what it did, in the sense that it made me confront my Judaism, it made me read and think a lot more about the historical moment that the Jews projected Jesus as their Savior. So as a historical question, just because these were the debates that I got into all the time, as I used to tell the Christians, you know, that's the question they would always ask me. Well, why did he reject Jesus? You know, you're telling us that our Savior is a fraud, basically, and you have to sort of craft an answer. And actually, I have to say it was mostly the parents who would put it that way. The kids, you know, are very respectful and respectful of grown-ups, which I am. And so I would get into it more with the parents. And the reason it's unusual for me is because, you know, the first thing to explain to them is that we don't think about Jesus an awful lot. You know, it's not that we sit around thinking, well, the reasons we rejected him are, you know, 1 through 100, that Judaism doesn't concern itself with Jesus. And I don't know if that's, you know, even more deeply insulting than coming up with an answer for their first question, but that's just the truth. So I really did have to engage the question of what is it between Jews and Jesus.
For our listeners and those who have not read the book yet, describe Patrick Henry College, which I believe was established in 2000.
Established in 2000. It's about an hour and a half outside Washington. It's built to resemble an Ivy League school, so though it's quite small, it's built in that Federalist style to look like quite an old college. It's just off a highway in Loudoun County, Virginia. As I said, you'd walk around campus, you wouldn't see a lot of kids holding hands or wearing ripped jeans or having crazy hair. You know, everybody dresses like a young intern would dress, partly for reasons of modesty and partly for reasons of trying to professionalize the kids at a young age. The social atmosphere would remind you of a different era, just in the way the kids behaved and the politeness and the neatness of their rooms. And so that's very evident for somebody who's used to a secular college. There are no boys allowed in girls' dorms and vice versa. And there is it's run by a courting principle, courting as opposed to dating, and courting is something popular among young conservative Christians, in which you involve the parents heavily in your dating decisions, and you don't have a lot of physical contact, and in many cases reserve your first kiss for your marriage. So these are things that make for a completely different atmosphere than you might see, than you would be used to if you went to a secular college.
And you said it almost resembled a scene from Meet Me in St. Louis.
Exactly. That's when I wrote about this, I would say that there were some aspects of it that I found fairly sweet and wholesome. It would look like a sort of mid-century play that way. You'd see girls kind of leaning out their window, talking to the boys who were outside in the grass, and the boys were fairly romantic. They might leave flowers for the girls or Valentine's Day gifts. There was a very romantic element to a courting atmosphere, and at other moments, it felt quite oppressive to me, and one of the students that I profile, because the book is more a series of profiles than it is kind of a polemic or an essay about the Christian right, one of the girls I profile is someone who's chafing against the system. The year I was there happened to be a very tumultuous year, and in the first semester, the problem involved some students who had been caught drinking and one of their friends who turned them in for drinking, and they were good friends with a student who I wrote about who was really kind of oppressed and felt quite judged by the other girls at the school, who would, you know, write her letters, your bra strap is showing, this is showing, and she felt really that the whole judgment of the school was coming down on her the whole year. And so that was the oppressive element, and then there was the romantic element.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, Patrick Henry is supported by the Republican Party, isn't it?
Yes, they do have close ties, and as we've all in the history of the Republican Party, there's always been a slight unease between the evangelical wing and the mainstream Republican Party, because evangelicals, once a president gets into the White House, are always demanding, okay, now end abortion right now. Now that we supported you and voted for you, you have to get rid of abortion tomorrow. And as any politician knows, that's not really possible. That said, the Republican Party, because since evangelicals have joined politics, and this is a process that's taken 30 or 40 years, they're really deeply embedded and enmeshed in the Republican Party in a way that seems hard to extricate. It's not merely that the president in 2004 used what any Christian would recognize as a Christian testimony about how he found Jesus and had been a drinker. That's just one element of it. There's also now 30% of congressmen define themselves as evangelicals, and that they could be Catholics, they could be all sorts of things, but that word evangelical has come to take on a political meaning and importance. And thirdly, there's just an established an evangelical establishment in Washington, which goes to think tanks and interest groups and lobbyists, and so there's really an establishment that feels fairly permanent now in Washington for evangelicals to be part of the Republican Party.
Now, I know that you write quite a bit about the number of internships is fairly high for Patrick Henry, given it's such a small school.
Yeah, that was always amazing. That's a statistic that really stands out about Patrick Henry, that the White House internship is fairly prestigious. They choose 100 White House interns every year, and they usually are chosen from among quite ambitious college students. And Patrick Henry had the same number as Georgetown. Now, Patrick Henry's a tiny school, you know, 5 years old when I wrote the book, and with 300 and some students, Georgetown is much older and much larger, and they still had the same number of interns. Patrick Henry would hold between 1 and 5 of the internships every year. I mean, every year you'd get that celebration of who's going to be the White House intern this year, who are the interns, and it's really quite remarkable given how small the school is.
I mean, to me, I don't see this as a problem, really. I mean, why are these internships so significant in your mind? I mean, to me,
it's not a problem. It's just that it's significant in showing how directed and focused they are, and mm-hmm. how specific is their mission that they really put a concentration on this. I think for most new schools, it would take them a long time before they worked up to have students successful, ambitious enough to have such prestigious internships. In the case of Patrick Henry, part of it comes from the way they structure their education. Half of the education is kind of a Christian classical education, so they're really studying the classics, Plato and Aristotle, and a Western civilization, the origins of America. The other half is that you get credits for having internships. It's almost vocational. They really are really preparing you to kind of be in the working world. It's like pre-job kind of thing. And so I think that's just a way of explaining the character of the school and what its mission is.
Some of the statistics you came up with, through the class of 2004, 61 grads, 2 work in the White House, 6 are on the staffs of conservative members of Congress, 8 are in federal agencies, 1 helps Senator Rick Santorum and his wife, homeschool of 6 kids. I guess this is a little dated now.
Right.
2 are in the FBI, another worked for the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq.
Right.
So they are, you would contest, they are making inroads into the government.
Absolutely, and I think that's because that's their very particular mission. It's not, you know, that they're smarter, or it's not that they're more ambitious than, say, your average Ivy League student. It's just that they, if you go to Patrick Henry, you tend to be attracted to it specifically because you're interested in getting a job in Washington. I would often run into students who had transferred from, you know, some large state school or a school that even, you know, maybe had a better reputation than Patrick Henry, because they knew that Patrick Henry was going to help them get to where they wanted to go, which was, you know, CIA, Secret Service, White House, someplace in Washington. I mean, now those numbers you read are quite outdated. There's a lot more kids who work in the White House and on the Hill, just because there's been a few classes since that one.
How does Patrick Henry position itself in some of the other classical evangelical schools, Bob Jones, Regent, for instance?
That's a very good question. They are most similar to Regent, I would say, because Regent has the same kind of mission. Regent also boasts on its website that 150 of its graduates worked at the White House. They are very directed to training the next generation of Christian leaders. It's a graduate school, so it's not the kids aren't as young as Patrick Henry kids, but they're very similar in kind of style and explicit mission. Bob Jones, the kids would say, you know, oh, that place is way oppressive, and you know, they would consider themselves to the left of Bob Jones, that a lot of the kids considered Bob Jones, which also has a high homeschooling population, but that they thought, oh, that's too much, you know, the rules are too much. They do curfews and room checks and car checks for your CDs, and they think it's, you know, too oppressive. And they would consider themselves to the right of, say, a place like Wheaton, which they would say has just become, you know, kind of too open, you know, the dancing and the kind of, they'll allow all kinds of students and professors in, and they're not as focused on their Christian mission as Patrick Henry would like to be. So I would say they would position themselves somewhere in between Wheaton and Bob Jones.
Okay. Listeners, I'd like you to call in. Our local number is 333-9455, long distance 1-800-222-9455, if you want to talk to Hannah Rosen about this fascinating book, God's Harvard. Talk about the founder, Michael Ferris. He seems like a very charismatic leader, if you will, even though, in a sense, he's a failed politician.
Yes, he's very interesting and a great visionary in a way. He is a very, in his 20s, after he'd gotten out of law school, he became involved in the Moral Majority and built basically the Moral Majority's largest office that was in Washington State and where he had grown up. And his father was a public school teacher, so he was always very interested in education. And he was one of these amazing, young, zealous Christian activists at a time when that type was extremely new on the American scene. And he would say things that were quite bombastic. He debated Timothy Leary and he would have these, and he would always wear a suit and call everybody, you know, Mister, and he would say, and he defended a lot of interesting court cases of evangelical parents, say, wanting to take certain books out of the school, or, you know, there was a case of the mother, a famous case he defended, of a divorce case in which the mother had been fairly uninvolved, but then the father had been gay and had gotten custody of his son, and the mother had become a Christian and wanted her son back because she didn't want her son anywhere near her ex-husband's gay lifestyle. So a lot of these real early culture war cases, he was at the forefront of a culture war. And then he ran for office and tried to temper his reputation in 1992, which was years after his Moral Majority years, but it was sort of too late. I mean, what happened in the campaign is that people would bring up these fairly bombastic things he had said about the role of women or about homosexuality or about books in school. They would run ads saying that he wanted to ban American classics, such as The Wizard of Oz, from our schools and make him really seem like an extremist. So in a sense, it was too late for him. He already had too much of a paper trail and a record of saying bombastic things. And so then he turned his mind to education and bringing up the next generation of Christian leaders who he would train to be less hot-headed than he was.
Let's take a call here. We've got a call from Champaign County. Listener, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether you... Hello? I'm wondering if this group connects with this group I've heard about called Christian Embassy, which recruits apparently Washington as quote-unquote establishment, and I think it's connected to more straight-ahead group called Campus Crusade for Christ. And I wonder if also you've been looking into the religiosity argument in the military, because apparently there's quite a bit of that. I think that's centered in Colorado Springs, but It reminds me that this fellow Jerry Boykins, Special Forces guy, who was notorious for lecturing and preaching at very fundamentalist megachurches in his uniform and talking about the Holy War, et cetera, et cetera. And it just seems like this whole milieu is
Well, let's let Hannah answer that.
Right.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
That's a very good question. I think the phenomenon I'm describing, which is Christians entering the mainstream and being more forthright in the next generation, really does show up in a lot of different places. And the military is one of them. There have been a few lawsuits over the last 2 years of soldiers suing because the chaplain, they feel, has aggressively tried to convert them and given preference to evangelicals. So that certainly is a phenomenon in the military. And the other groups he mentioned are existing, too, in different forms. Now, Campus Crusade for Christ has been around a long time, but they are actually moving into a new mode. You know, Campus Crusade used to be in that old kind of aggressive, convert everyone to Christ, have Christian groups all over campuses mode. And they're doing something more subtle, too, like they sponsor a film festival now, which runs in New York, which allows people to just run films about religiosity in general, and it's become quite a popular film festival because in Hollywood these days, people don't want sort of Billy Graham movies. Everybody understands that's not the way to go about it, that you have to make a movie which promotes certain values and has kind of subtle Christian metaphors that you might or might not pick up on, but which is, you know, which is kind of delicate and tells a good story anyway. And so they're kind of operating in the new sophisticated mode as well. And in terms of Christian Embassy, there are lots of groups in Washington that promote young interns, Christian interns on the Hill. They're kind of networking groups. They sort of help Christians find jobs, and Patrick Henry kids are connected to those groups, and I've been to lunch with some of those groups, and the interns, it's kind of a way for a young Christian to get a job. You know, it's left over from the days when Christians were really outsiders to politics, and it just creates, it's not nefarious or anything, but it creates a kind of network on the Hill so that, you know, you're a Christian, you need a job, you sort of call around, you know, which of the conservative congressmen needs a job, who's friendly to Christians, you know, who likes to hire Christians, and of course you don't go to your interview and the chief of staff doesn't say, hey, are you Christian? But, you know, there's ways of recognizing each other without asking the question outright.
Yeah, certainly that's not an unusual thing. I mean, we're talking to you from Illinois. So,
right.
We have a call here from beautiful Urbana, home of the University of Illinois. Go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Hello.
Patrick Henry, what is their science and math curriculum like if they are, in fact, fundamentalist and are they accredited by the reviewing authority here in the Midwest? I think it's the North Central Association. I don't know what the authority is at this college. What do you have to say on that? And then I have a bone to pick with you. Please emphasize again and again that these are fundamentalist Christians and not the reasonable mainstream Christians such as the Presbyterians and the Methodists. So I'll listen to your answer.
Thank you, caller.
Twofold answer. I'll start with the question about science and math because this is one of the most interesting things about the school. They teach six-day creationism, old earth creationism. Young earth creationism. It's the old fundamentalist notion of biblical literalism as applied to science. That said, the creationist movement has changed dramatically in the next few years, and I'm about to write about this subject as well. The people who teach this are people with very legitimate biology degrees from University of Virginia. In the case of the year I was there, I just went to a creationist conference in which there was a student of Stephen Jay Gould's who had gotten his PhD in paleontology from Harvard. There is a new generation of creationists as well who are extremely well-educated, and they believe in pure science and pure faith. Now, if you're a scientist who's, you know, but not a fundamentalist scientist, you'll go to one of their conferences and, you know, just bang your head against the wall in frustration. But they really try to operate in the mode of pure faith and pure science at the same time. Now, this is one of the most difficult things about Patrick Henry. I think Michael Farris must know that if he sends his students out into a Republican Party convention talking about how the earth was created in 6 days, that's sort of the social equivalent of going out there and saying you have two wives. It's just not that social socially acceptable. Even though lots of Americans believe that, that's not something that politicians usually say out loud. So this is one of the kinks they have to smooth out. But on the other hand, there really is a kind of new mode of being a fundamentalist creationist, which they're trying to work out and which may or may not succeed, but it is the way they think about it. Now, the second question was about the difference between fundamentalist and evangelical. This is a critical question. And part of my writing this book is to try and complicate that old distinction, because I think that the distinction isn't as neat as we would like it to be anymore. Fundamentalists have a certain history in American cultural life of sort of retreating out of politics after the Scopes trial and then debating with a new group of evangelicals about whether they should reengage in politics or not. But I think at a certain point, those distinctions almost lost their meaning. So this is part of the reason I was attracted to Patrick Henry, because you have fundamentalists who are operating in an open evangelical mode, and some of the things they bring along with them, such as the idea of six-day creation, and you know, this notion of evangelizing and saving the world. But some of the things are very evangelical, and things we associate with Carl Henry and some of the leaders of the evangelical movement from the 40s, which is we really need to engage this culture. We will not retreat. We're not going to be in the background. We're going to claim our seat at the table. We're going to be involved in politics. And I'm not saying they figured this out. Part of the reason I wrote this book is to show the contradictions of this new mode of operation, which, because it's so new, I think haven't been ironed out quite yet.
I would add, and this is important, that Hannah Rosin is not new to this subject. She was a religion reporter for the Washington Post for how many years?
For many years. Was the job I had sort of 9 or 10 years ago, and since then it's just remained an interest of mine. So even when I've written about other subjects, I always return back to this one.
And we've had the pleasure of reading you in many publications throughout the years. Now we have a call from Belgium. Is that the country or the town? The town of Belgium. Go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
It's a town.
Yep, I know.
Okay. Okay. These students who come out of this college and they go straight to the White House. Okay. Now, what percentage of them would ever consider doing any kind of social work in an inner city?
Okay, that's a great question. Thank you, caller.
And that would be a real wake-up call. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Do they end up in positions of, I would say, social work, or are they headed right to the high corridors of government?
This is the argument that sort of Jim Wallace and the religious left, maybe we could call them, that's starting to arise and sort of bring its voice into the political arena has with the Christian right. There are certainly many, many evangelicals who do, you know, prison ministry. We all know of Chuck Colson, who's established a fabulous prison ministry and work in the inner cities and start schools and everything, but not this crowd particularly. I did not know many kids who did a lot of social work or, you know, spoke about the New Orleans situation in any kind of compassionate way. It was more sort of a political way of, not quite they deserved it, but, you know, a little bit of, you know, just lacking in some compassion that you would want. So while it's not true of evangelicals or even fundamentalists in general, I think they do some amazing work in places where the rest of us never see. This crowd was really intent on affecting things from the top down and not from the bottom up. The kind of volunteer work they would do would generally further their own mission, so they would work in sort of Awana groups, you know, Christian, suburban sort of Boy Scout kind of leagues and that kind of thing, but not a lot of real inner city social work.
I like these kids that you describe in the book. They have great values. They don't go out drinking and causing riots on campus. Yet you present them almost as if they're sort of tragic in a sense. And I get a feeling throughout the book that we should be somehow concerned about them. But why should we be concerned about them? They seem like great kids.
I don't think we should be concerned about them. It's funny you should use the word tragic. I never thought about it that in that loaded way, that's the impression that comes across. I guess I think more that they're placed in this position with a lot of pressure on them, and there's just a lot for them to work out. Whether society as a whole should be concerned about them, that sort of depends on your viewpoint. In terms of the way they live their life, absolutely not. They're sort of a moral example, and the choices they make for themselves are okay choices, and quite admirable choices in some cases. They get married young. They're very ambitious. They live cleanly. The only issue I would take in terms of their lifestyle has to do with self-knowledge and giving a little more breathing room to know yourself and rebel a little bit. I think that is missing from that culture, sort of a sense of independence and not deep reliance on authority all the time. That's the only lifestyle question. Now, in terms of politics, whether we should worry about them, that depends on your political position. If you're a Democrat, you would worry a lot. And if you're a Christian, you would look at them and say, fine, admirable kids who are going to, fix my politics in the next 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another, and I want to get back to these kids, too, in a minute, but let's take another call. This one's from Bartlett. Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wonder now, if you're a politician, you're running on something. To me, personally, I think it doesn't matter what your faith is. To me, it's not about the faith at all. It's about getting the job done, and I think that's what a lot of people want. Although, I will admit, some of the people out there are looking at the faith, the religious faith, as that's going to determine the way a person, would react as far as some of these referendums and all the things that go on down in Washington. Now, I don't have a problem with it because I'm a religious faith also, but I do kind of wonder sometimes that these people that are anti-religious seem to be bringing down this country, when the majority of this country is religious based. I guess what I'm saying in my point here is that it doesn't make sense for me for anybody to see a minority group of people want to bring it down just because they believe there's no God or there's nothing out there. I just don't understand it. And is there a way that we can make them understand? Can't we all get along? I mean, I look at it this way. It doesn't matter what faith you are, whether you're Jewish or you're Catholic or Lutheran or Baptist or Methodist, you're all the same. We're all one big happy family. We're supposed to be, and it just seems like it plays too much in the political spectrum. Is there a way that we can keep that out of it not have a problem with it?
Great points, caller. How do you respond to that, Hanna?
This is something that the kids would tell me all the time. Do you understand, Hanna, that you're the unusual one, that all these questions you're asking me are questions that any American would agree with and know instinctively, that if you didn't live in Washington, D.C., but you lived in, Orlando or Illinois, someplace else, then you wouldn't find anything that I'm saying so unusual. And I take that to heart. I've been covering religion. That's a lesson I learned almost on my second month of covering religion, that, in fact, it was the newsroom that sort of misunderstood the rest of America at some level and have made it a mission to kind of explain to the rest of America, and that's the tradition I hope this book is in, just kind of, just give you a window into kind of what most of the country thinks. Now, I have to say, the kids that I write about are not like most of the country. I mean, I almost call them sort of a delta force of evangelical Christians. They're more focused, and they're not just people who are Christian and believe in God. In polls, they show up. There's sort of a 30% that show up as, religion is extremely important in their lives among Christians, and they go to church regularly, more than once a week, and they follow all the dictates that they're taught by their pastor. And so they are a minority in that sense, although in their broader views, both about creationism or about God, they are more similar to the rest of America than, your average newspaper newsroom.
But they are learning some of the, let's say they are studying evolution a little bit, but only as what they call opposition research, correct?
Right, exactly.
Okay. Exactly. Let's take another call. This is from a cell phone in Bloomington, Illinois. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
Hi.
Very interesting show. Just a couple of quick questions, and I'll go ahead and ring off. My question is actually about the internship themselves, what it involved. The reason I'm asking that is when I was in college 30 years ago, I was an intern with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, my senior year, and with a group called the Washington Center for Learning Alternatives. But there, it was very, I mean, we made copies. It was a hoot to be in Washington, but it wasn't anything that prepared us for work in Washington. And I was just wondering, is it more substantial now? And then way back, you were talking about Bob Jones and comparing it. I thought you said Wheaton. Are you talking about the Wheaton College, which is a suburb of Chicago, or is there, did I misunderstand you?
No, that is the college, isn't it, Anna?
Yeah, I'm talking about Wheaton College in Illinois, which is a famous and old evangelical college, but which has been around a long time so that it's lost some of that edge of extremism that Christian colleges have. So, yes, Wheaton is a well-respected, and I would say in the rankings of kind of where the highest SAT scores of Christian students, I think Wheaton is first.
Mm-hmm. It certainly wouldn't be Patrick Henry.
No, although Patrick Henry's second or third, just because it's so mm-hmm. intense, even though it just came around yesterday. I can't remember if it's second or third, but it's just behind Wheaton in terms of the success, you know, the resumes of students that go there.
Mm-hmm. We have a call from Champaign. Go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Hello.
I tuned in very late, and I don't know what evangelical is. Could you please explain that to me?
Yes, that's a great question. Evangelical is a fairly new term, and when I wrote an obituary for Jerry Falwell, I laughed because I thought everybody's going to call him an evangelical leader, and that's going to be a word he never used in his life. In the 40s, there came a debate started by Carl Henry, and Billy Graham was part of this movement, and they said, we don't want to call ourselves fundamentalists anymore. That word has taken up, you know, so many negative connotations that we want to move towards this thing of calling ourselves evangelicals, people who evangelize, because that that implies engagement with the world and being out there and doing something, not fundamentalist, which has an element of retreat and hiding from the world. And so over time, over the last 50 years, that term evangelical came into more common usage, and it became almost a political term. When you say in Washington that somebody is an evangelical, it implies a set of political policies and a dedication to the Republican Party. So it has as much of a sort of social cultural term, a connotation, as it does an actual theological connotation. There's some, a few academics have tried to define it because it's a fuzzy definition and said, you know, an evangelical is somebody who loves Billy Graham.
Hmm.
That's where they define the split. So it is a very fuzzy term.
Yes, I can understand. Now we have a cell phone caller. Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I belong to one of the historic peace churches.
Yes.
I would consider myself on the religious left, and I really, like the caller from Champaign County, take offense that you keep saying Christians. You said if you're Christian, you would not consider these this trend alarming, and I consider it very alarming. And so would a lot of mainstream and left-wing Christians.
That's a fabulous correction, and I thank you for making it. I do use these terms loosely, like Christian evangelical, and they're absolutely not equivalent. I mean, there are some Christians who, when I tell them about Patrick Henry, are absolutely horrified, honestly. They say, that's not what Christianity is. There are some fundamentalists who are horrified because they, you know, retain this idea that it's inappropriate for Christians to be so involved in politics. You can have that feeling from the right and that feeling from the left, so I should absolutely not lump all Christians, which represents the majority of this nation, into the Patrick Henry crowd. They're a very specific brand of modern evangelicals.
Let's talk a little bit about the students, because to me they steal the show to some extent in the book, and they're just fascinating. The tip of the spear, I guess, is what Ferris would refer to them as.
Right.
Tell me about Derek Archer. And also, if you could explain the role of homeschooling in this movement as well.
Yeah, sure. I'll explain it through Derek Archer since he was homeschooled. Derek Archer is a freshman I read about, and I chose him because I wanted to choose somebody who was new to the school and had just come from a kind of homeschooling environment into this place of great intensity and ambition, and somebody who was really new and fresh and in their first year. He is from Ohio, and he is the son of missionaries, and he was homeschooled. And homeschooling is a movement that has existed for a long time but became very popular among conservative Christians throughout the 90s. And it's a movement that basically decided that public schools were teaching kids the wrong values, that they were at some level godless monstrosities, as Michael Ferris, the founder of the school, likes to say. And so Christians decided they wanted to teach their kids at home. Now, in most places, this was illegal, and it took a lot of hard-won legal battles in order to win that right, and most of those were fought by Michael Farris, which is why he's so well-known in the movement. And so this movement exploded, and it basically means the mother teaches the kids at home, that you have the kids around the kitchen table, and the mother has the lesson plan, and the lesson plan gets sent in to these accrediting authorities, who then send it back to you. So it's quite well established. There's established curriculum now, and there's even homeschooling teams and things. You can meet with other homeschoolers in your community and form a sports team or a film league or all kinds of things. And so that's what homeschooling is like. And then the one great thing about homeschooling is that it doesn't take too long to finish your schoolwork if you don't have a lot of other distractions and recess. And so the kids have a lot of time for independent pursuits, which is part of the reason they do it. And for a kid who's very politically interested, such as Derek Archer, he spent a lot of his free time campaigning and did a huge amount of campaigning for the Bush administration and was still able to get his work done. So what I write about Derek Archer is that he is extremely devout, and his father's a pastor, and like I said, they grew up in Papua New Guinea as a missionary family. And in any other generation, I think Derek Archer would have ended up as a missionary or a pastor himself because his zeal is so strong. But in this generation, he was able to plug that passion in a different direction and do what he calls the ministry of political activism. And he was really turned on by first going to a Patrick Henry summer camp and then working on the Bush administration, and like I said, the 2004 campaign was really exhilarating for some of these kids, as was having Bush as president. And so then he came to Patrick Henry, and he was still, I would say, a little naive and kind of and learned a lot more throughout the year or two that I knew him about politics and what politics was like and sort of the corruptions in politics, and it really, he got a lot wiser by the end of the 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Urbana. Go ahead, caller. Here talking to Hannah Rosen, author of God's Harvard.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hi.
Interesting subject. Sort of marginal still, though. I think their influence is not as pronounced as one people. You know, it's like a good PR campaign on their part. But I was going to say that there's a recent book published in England about Protestantism, which sort of fits into your thesis, where in which the author said that Protestantism is caught in an endless loop of message, charismatics, interpretation of message, disappointment in the charismatic, and then back to the message reinterpretation, back to the charismatic. He actually started back with Luther himself. And I'm wondering if you sort of see this in, you know, the modern evangelical, the, you know, ministers who sort of fall out of favor with the flock and become corrupt, or, I mean, it's endemic with this sort of the behavior of these people. They're sort of, they set these ideal situations up, and then everything falters because you can't live up to these ideals they've set for themselves. And I'm wondering if you think, what you think of that.
I think that is that interpretation would overlay pretty well over Patrick Henry, in the sense that, you know, they come in with these incredibly idealistic expectations about their ability to influence politics, and this has been somewhat the mode that fundamentalists or evangelicals have engaged with politics over the last many years, and so they really have incredibly high expectations of how they can rescue the nation tomorrow morning, and then they realize it really doesn't work that way, and then they're gravely disappointed and in many cases just drop out. By the end of the book, this freshman, now he's a young kid, but you know, he's 19 at this point, is you know, is kind of disillusioned. Like, he came in with such high expectations and was taught such a high standard for how he should engage that by the end he's thinking to himself, well, I mean, Newt Gingrich, all these people I, you know, loved and respected, why didn't anyone tell me Newt Gingrich was having an affair, or that all these presidential candidates are on their second and third marriages, you know, the Republicans? And it really does come as a sort of, you know, tender disappointment to him to learn about these things. So I think you're right. Now, that said, I think that because we're in the second generation of professional political engagement, that Christians will become more sophisticated in how they evaluate candidates and how they evaluate policy. Probably the most popular and well-known, like you said, the leaders, these sort of charismatic leaders that arise right now, is Rick Warren from the Saddleback Church in California. And he and Rick Warren is in a different mode. He is quite careful about how he engages with politics and what kind of expectations he raises. He's no different in what he believes in terms of policy or theology, but he really does operate in a slightly different mode. He makes sure to invite, you know, Sam Brownback, the evangelical candidate, as well as Barack Obama, the Democratic candidate, because he does not want to be seen as in that old way of engaging politics.
good marketing on their part. I was wondering if just to comment, if you'd comment on their the fact that do these people? I mean, there's a recent publication of Mother Teresa supposedly having this crisis in faith, which is obvious with these people because one thing, their ideals never live up to the reality of their lives and their observation. You know, and I always think that when there's a guy who wrote something years ago, I mean, 20 years ago, maybe in a sense that religion in itself sets itself up for a failure because its attempts to describe the results of the, you know, the universe itself, the reasons for being and all this stuff, inherently fail because it's basically all a belief system which is subject to, you know, redaction and reinterpretation, which falls into the, you know, cyclical thing in Protestantism. But it's interesting that the modern science is sort of debunked, like as you said earlier about the creationist people and stuff like that. And in reality, I mean, science just rolls along collecting information and proving its database, proving its theories and its theses. And religion is stuck in a basically a 3,000-year-old documents, which basically are irrelevant in any real instance to reality. But I think, thanks a lot. It sounds like a really interesting book.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you so much.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about Farron Morgan, one of the female students.
Sure. She is the student I chose because she sort of chafes against the system.
Right.
She's uncomfortable under it. And she was from West Virginia, and she was a dancer, a ballerina. And she's quite attractive, and she's also kind of a loner. And so what I write about her is that for whatever reason, she became the focus of a lot of gossip at the school. And this tends to happen where one girl at the school kind of attracts all the gossip and the negative attention, whether they deserve it or not. It's not that she dressed provocatively or, you know, occasionally she would like to provoke her roommates, as I wrote, by saying she was going to Victoria's Secret, and then she would say, you know, girls, everyone wears a bra, you know, which is not really racy and out there, but it was her way of kind of poking at the situation around her. And she was always sort of irritated by the kind of happy, happy, everything has to be fantastic, wonderful, and determined all the time kind of talk that she heard from her classmates. And so she does feel fairly oppressed by the system, and she, by the end of the year, ends up leaving the school, which, of course, I didn't know when I chose her as a candidate but I do write about someone who's kind of squirming under the system. In addition to that, her friends did get in trouble for drinking. There was a large incident. It was quite a tumultuous year, and there were two big incidents that happened during the year I was there, one involving the students and one involving the professors. And in the one involving the students, a lot of students got in trouble for drinking. And I just write about the way in which the school hunted them down and how they were turned in by their roommate. And it just, you know, it shows a certain kind of element of this Christian culture. And then in terms of the professor, that was really, really a hard moment for the school.
That was Robert Stacey.
Yeah, that was Robert Stacey, who was a teacher who taught government. And basically, there were differing views between the professors and the founder of the school about how you teach liberal arts and the views of the founding fathers. And I think for Michael Ferris, as you mentioned, he really thought of the liberal arts as kind of opposition research, and that's what he would tell the homeschooling parents. You know, the reason we're studying the Greeks and all these people we think of as slightly corrupted is because we want to learn how the other half thinks. You know, it would be like studying a battle plan of Baghdad. You know, we just want to kind of get to know our enemy better. And the professors, of course, didn't think that way. They were people who spent their whole careers and gotten PhDs, again, from places like UVA and, you know, really quite excellent universities studying Nietzsche, Plato, the founding fathers, and so they presented views of these things which would be, which were from a Christian worldview, but still academically rigorous and correct. And there was a showdown between Michael Ferris and one of the professors about his lack of fidelity to the biblical worldview, and all the other professors kind of teamed up with this professor because they felt it was too threatening, that they would be way too vulnerable if they had to live up to these high standards and worry about every word that they said in class. And so it ended up being a showdown between the most popular and respected professor at the school and the founder of the school, in which many of the professors had to leave by the end of it.
Where did Robert Stacey end up?
He ended up at Regent University.
Regent, that's correct.
So yes. It's quite similar. He ended up at Regent teaching government there and is quite happy. It's a bigger university and it's a research university. And I think because Patrick Henry is so new, I think, you know, every year is like a historical epic and everything has such grand implications for their identity and what kind of school they're going to be. So it's a much, much more intense environment than even a similar Christian school would be.
Let's take one more call from beautiful Charleston, Illinois. Go ahead, Carl. Caller, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Is that me?
Yep, that's you from Charleston.
Ah, right. No, you got us mixed up. Actually, I'm the one from Urbana.
Okay.
But that's okay. Thanks for having the show. I really appreciate your station and your program.
Thank you.
Hi, Hannah. Very quickly, I'll just make a couple of comments, a question, and then I'll hang up.
Why don't you just do your question, because we're running short on time, caller.
Right. Okay, no problem. My question has to do with your conflation of Christianity, the Founding Fathers, and American. And I'm wondering, one of the callers made the statement that the Christians were the majority in this country. I don't know when that of Americans, not just religious.
What's your question, caller?
I just made two questions. I don't know if you caught those or not.
I will just say that I have a chapter devoted in my book to this very question of who the Founding Fathers were and the kind of the evangelical fundamentalist reinterpretation of the Founding Fathers, which is going on strongly now, and the different views of that at the school. And the professor I talked about, Robert Stacey, he really had one view of who the Founding Fathers were, which was quite an accurate view, which almost any historian would agree with, whereas the administration of the school really followed the Christian revisionist model, which seemed to portray the Founding Fathers as much more Christian than they actually were, or I should say as fitting into the modern-day evangelical mode, which they do not. You can't really describe them in those terms. So that was one of the intellectual foundations of the argument that happened in the second semester at the school, which I explore in my book.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time, and I'd like to thank all the callers that called in and the ones we didn't get to. I apologize. We've had just a lot of callers, and that's good. And, Hanna, you've given us much to debate and much to talk about, which is always a sign of a great book. And, again, the book is called God's Harvard, A Christian College on a Mission to Save America. I highly recommend it. It will definitely feed your mind and give you a lot to think about in the years to come. Thank you, Hanna, for being
with
us.
Thank you so much.